This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, August 23rd, 2012. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, the early days of poetry. This year, Poetry Magazine is celebrating the 100th anniversary of its founding. And this fall, the current editors are publishing an anthology of some of the best poetry to appear over the last century in the magazine. It's called The Open Door, 100 Poems, 100 Years of Poetry Magazine. And over the course of the year, the magazine itself has been republishing some great stuff that they couldn't squeeze into that anthology. 100 years is a long time for a small literary magazine to last. Apart from a great title, one wonders, what did Poetry Magazine have that gave it staying power? Well, to start, it had Harriet Monroe, who published T.S. Eliot's Proof Rock and Wallace Stevens's Sunday Morning and other classics of modernism that we're still talking about today. And to talk about Harriet Monroe and the early days of poetry, I'm joined by Steve Young, who is the program director of the Poetry Foundation. Steve, you know the history of Poetry Magazine about as well as anyone. Can you tell us why Harriet Monroe founded the magazine in the first place and what she hoped to accomplish?
Yeah, she felt that serious poets lacked their own forum at the time. Poetry in the early part of the 20th century was relegated to the ends of newspaper columns. It was her feeling that serious poets really had no forum, no place to publish their works and to reach their audience.
So by 1912, when she started the magazine, modernism was in full swing in Europe. Picasso and Braque had already invented cubism. Igor Stravinsky was coming out with some of his great ballets. But culture in the U.S. probably seemed pretty provincial, didn't it?
I think that's right, especially in poetry. Huh. And in fact, one of Harriet's jobs was art critic for the Tribune. And she wrote in her review of the famous Armory show, "Either these pictures are good or they are not. If they are good, they will make their way in spite of objections. If not, they will perish without the aid of objections. Better the wildest extravagance of the cubists than the lifeless works of certain artists who ridicule them. They represent a search for new beauty, impatience with formulae, a reaching out toward the inexpressible, a longing for new versions of truth."
So she was a true champion of modernism from the very beginning.
She really was, yeah. And she looked around her in the city of Chicago and saw that the Art Institute had recently been established, the symphony had been established, and she felt that poetry needed a similar venue.
Mm-hmm. But while she was a big proponent of modernism, as an editor, she didn't necessarily turn her back on older, more genteel modes of poetry, did she?
No, it's odd. You know, we think of Poetry Magazine as one of the mouthpieces of modernism, and it is that, but it also published quite a lot of very conventional work that has not endured at all and that seems downright stale and fusty to us nowadays.
Yeah, can you read an example of one of the more conservative poems that she published in the early days?
Yeah, this is from the very first issue, October 1912, and I, you know, I hate to single out a particular poet for this this example.
Well, but it's 100 years have gone by. It's okay.
That's right, and she's not well remembered. It's a poem called "Fish of the Flood" by Amelia Stuart Lorimer.
All right, have at it.
"Fish of the flood, on the banked billow, thou layest thy head in dreams, sliding as slides thy shifting pillow, one with the streams. Of the sea is thy spirit. Jean tree, thou spreadest thy foaming flourish abroad in the sky so gray. It not heeding if it thee nourish, thou dost obey. Happy it's moving. So, God, thy love it not needeth me, only thy life that I blessed be."
That was "Fish of the Flood" by Amelia Stuart Lorimer. Now, if I were reading that magazine, if that's the first issue of poetry, I would not expect to see T.S. Eliot a couple years later or Ezra Pound or all these people. What was this poem doing in the magazine at that time?
Well, I think that editors are always captive of poems that are submitted to them for their consideration. Harriet was also aware, I think, that she couldn't simply publish a magazine that included the radical innovations of Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. Nobody would read it. It needed some balance, and it needed some works that would be more accessible to the reading public, things that would not make them throw the magazine down and say, what the heck is this?
Yeah. Now, well, one of the curiosities here is that Harriet Monroe's own poetry was fairly conventional, wouldn't you say?
It was. I think she would have loved to have been remembered as a poet, but in fact, her legacy is as a really brilliant and far-seeing editor.
Mm. Let's hear another poem published in the early days. Can you give us an example of something a bit more adventurous than the poem you just read?
Sure. This is a poem that was published in November 1914. Harriet's assistant, Alice Corbin Henderson, decided that the November issue would be devoted to war poetry, and a prize would be offered for the best war poem submitted.
Uh-huh.
Harriet wasn't very comfortable with this idea. She thought that poets were somewhat complicit in promoting war and glorifying it. And she also thought the idea of offering a prize for a war poem was a little bit unseemly, given what was going on in Europe at the time. But here's a poem called Phases.
And tell us who it's by.
It is by Wallace Stevens.
Okay, I've heard of him.
There's a little square in Paris waiting until we pass. They sit idly there. They sip the glass. There's a cab horse at the corner. There's rain. The season grieves. It was silver once and green with leaves. There's a parrot in a window. We'll see us on parade. Hear the loud drums roll and serenade. This was the salty taste of glory, that it was not like Agamemnon's story, only an eyeball in the mud, and Hopkins, flat and pale and gory. But the bugles in the night were wings that bore to where our comfort was, arabesques of candle beams winding through our heavy dreams, winds that blew where the bending iris grew, birds of intermitted bliss, singing in the night's abyss, vines with yellow fruit that fell along the walls that bordered hell. Death's nobility again beautified the simplest men. Fallen Winkle felt the pride of Agamemnon when he died. What could London's work and waste give him to that salty, sacrificial taste? What could London's sorrow bring to that short, triumphant sting?
Now, that's kind of an astonishing poem to me, especially given the date. It was published in Poetry in 1914. World War I had just gotten started that summer, the summer before. The images are very much of World War I, of especially that image, an eyeball in the mud and Hopkins, flat and pale and gory.
Pretty stark.
Pretty stark, and quite unusual for a poet to take this attitude toward, this kind of ironic attitude towards the war as it was getting going, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think very much so. The poem kind of plays back and forth between sort of a glorified notion of war and the more straightforward, grim realities of it. And one of the things that's really, I think, new about it is that it's put together kind of as a collage. You know, the first section is very different from the second section and so on. But the whole picture gives you this sense of both the heroism involved in war and yet also its great emptiness and desolation.
Tell me about where Wallace Stevens was at this time. Was he actually living in Europe? It seems like he was in London and saw some of the preparations for war and the parades and things like that, or in Paris.
No, he was living in Greenwich Village, I believe, at the time.
Okay.
And he was completely unknown to Harriet Monroe. She wrote in her bio note for him, "Mr. Wallace Stevens is unknown to the editor at this time." She wrote him back asking for more information, and he wrote her explaining that he was a lawyer living in New York and that this was his first professional publication.
Mm-hmm. So part of her skill as an editor was in cultivating relationships with the super talented poets of the time like Wallace Stevens and recognizing his talent to begin with, but keeping in touch with them over the years and developing a relationship.
Yeah, that's right. If I could, I'd like to read a letter that she wrote him in August 1932. So this is, you know, almost 20 years later, and he has continued to submit to the magazine, published his first collection, Harmonium. And in 1932, Poetry Magazine was in financial straits, and she wrote him, "Dear Mr. Stevens, of course I want your scrap for October, and if you find or write any other scraps, I beg you to send them on. I am glad you would like to come to the aid of poetry. Shall I whisper a confidential word into your ear? If poetry stops, I shan't feel so bad as some other people seem to. I shall be quite willing to retire and write my memoirs. 20 years are a long time to stay at this job. I think I have done my share. At least I am finally resolved not to go on raising money for it. But that's not important compared with your deserting your job. Is there anything, anything I can do to keep you keen for it? Don't you ever come west these days. Yours cordially, Harriet Monroe. P.S. I hope Holly is well and as beautiful as ever." Holly was Stephen's daughter.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's anything that's continued in poetry that bears Harriet Monroe's mark on the magazine?
Yeah, I hope that her notion of the open door, whereby the magazine would publish simply the best poetry that was submitted, no matter where it came from or under what theory or in what school it was written, would find a place in the magazine. And I think that, you know, I know the current editors and past editors have really kept that principle of the open door in mind. It makes for an awful lot of work to be both so welcoming and receptive to work, and yet at the same time, to be able to discriminate between what's the best and what ought to find its way back to the author with a kind rejection slip.
Steve Young, thanks so much.
Thank you, Curtis.
In upcoming podcasts, we're going to be hearing more about the 100 Years of Poetry magazine. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.